For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Gyoshin Laurel Ross. I know most of you. Happy to be giving the talk this evening. You might notice I'm a little croaky, so I'm going to do my best, but if I fade off, just know I'm doing my best. So tonight, I want to talk about one of my favorite ancient dragon traditions, camping sesshin. So I'm calling it a tradition, but it was created only a few years ago. And someone asked me recently what it was and why we do it. And I thought those were some good questions. So I'm going to try to provide a few answers tonight. And let me just say, there are others in the room who have been part of creating our camping tradition, and I hope they will offer their own thoughts during the discussion, or during the talk, for that matter. Jerry has been part of camping sesshin, and Matt has been part of camping sesshin, and I'll single out Aishin, who deserves the credit for originating the idea, in 2016. So I'm going to describe some of what we've done, but I want to say that it's been an important principle that both the forms and the content of camping sesshin are always evolving, and that we like that. So sometimes a brilliant idea presents itself, and we incorporate it into our existing plan. But more often than not, we are responding to some and adapting to some unforeseen, uncontrollable conditions like weather or insects or equipment failure. And I'm really sincere when I say that that part is a lot of fun, especially when we overcome some adversity. So the first year we had perfect weather, and throughout the whole, we do it for 3 nights and 4 days. But last year we had high winds and heavy rain on the very first night, and the Zendo tent never quite recovered, though we did manage. So let me start by just describing in general terms what we do. We reserve a cluster of tent sites at Illinois Beach State Park, which is a very large and biologically diverse natural area. It's on Lake Michigan up at the northern border of Illinois. And then each participant sets up a tent for sleeping, and then we set up a larger Zendo tent where we do most of our zazen. And the Zendo tent, as I mentioned, has been among the most dynamic features of camping sesshin, and we've learned to pack a lot of duct tape. But I want to make it clear that the Zendo tent is not the camping version of the temple. The camping version of the temple is the place itself. So I'm going to, for the first time, as many times tonight, quote Gary Snyder. So he's an American who has practiced extensively in Japan, and he makes this comment. In the Western Hemisphere, we have only the tiniest number of buildings that can be called temples. The temples of our hemisphere will be some of the planet's remaining wilderness areas. So the place, the natural areas, is our temple. He's saying our most precious treasures in the Western world are natural rather than cultural. And not that one's better than the other, but they're equivalently wondrous. So we also set up an area that's for the kitchen and eating, and we have a fire in the evening, but we cook with the blessings of electricity for our other meals. And our schedule is it's loosely based on a traditional sesshin schedule with some adjustments. So a particularly beautiful thing that we've kept to is to rise very early each morning to sit in Zazen on the beach on a zabuton, which is protected from the sand by being in a garbage bag. And we sit facing the lake while the sun rises. So this year, we moved, we're doing this the third week in June. We had done it in July and August, but because we're doing it earlier in the summer, maybe we're going to get up really early this year because the days are longest the third week in June. So we'll be getting up at 4:30. And then we walk in the dark to the beach, which is about a few hundred yards away from our tent sites. We walk in silence, and then we sit while the world wakes up. And the birds and other living things wake up with us. It's truly a fine experience. So I'm going to quote a non-traditional Zen master, Jim Morrison, probably showing my age here. He says, "No eternal reward will forgive us now for wasting the dawn." So we try not to waste the dawn in camping session. And then afterwards, every morning, we, after sitting, we eat breakfast in silence with meal chants, abbreviated meal chants, and then we change clothes and go for a fairly long silent walk on one of the trails at the park. And I assume everyone has a different experience on these walks. For me, they are just sublime. Most times, I feel really alert and available. So for whatever sort of presents itself. Flowers being pollinated, visited by pollinators, enormous oak trees, birdsong, critters. And we also see all kinds of human-generated garbage. Sometimes we pick this up as we walk as kind of reverse takahatsu. So in takahatsu, monks in Japan walk the streets with empty bowls collecting food for their sustenance. And we walk with empty bags collecting refuse. So sometimes we experience unpleasant heat or insects or rough terrain or flooded trails. But, you know, in spite of these things or maybe because of these things, the trail is just a beautiful place. And it's just an opportunity to see things in a fresh way. We don't talk or interact with each other at all during these walks. But much as in the Zendo, we're sitting together, we're walking in a way that feels intimate. I feel intimate with you sitting with you in a Zendo, even though we're not talking or making hand signals or whatever. So we do these, this is sort of, these walks are an important part of our Sesshin experience. So I'm going to quote Snyder again. He says, "The wilderness pilgrims step by step, breath by breath, walk up a trail is so ancient a set of gestures as to bring a profound sense of body-mind joy. The point is to make intimate contact with the real world, real self." He's a big fan of walking. So in Zen, we're told that we ground our understanding in direct experience. I didn't get that for a long time. When I first started practicing, I just didn't really know what they're talking about. It took me a while to realize they're talking about a lot of, not just sitting on the cushion experience, but experience off the cushion. Microphone. So, as Zen students, we turn to books a lot, and we try to learn from teachings in books, try to learn about interconnectedness and dependent co-arising and suchness. But my experience is that our awakening comes not from only from studying and sitting. I'm not saying those aren't important, but paying attention to our senses and investigating ourselves wherever we are. So we learn from a lot of different teachers, and when we're outdoors, we're learning to accept nature as a teacher. And that's not just Zen or Buddhism. That's part of pretty much every spiritual tradition. You know, the Taoists, the Transcendentalists, John Muir, and so many more. The mystical traditions all embrace connection with nature. So for a long time, I had as my email signature a quote from Albert Einstein. He said, "Look deep, deep into nature, and then you will understand everything better." So even the religion of science looks to nature. So we camping Zen students get to know a little bit our special place, Illinois Beach State Park, by taking these walks every morning and paying attention. So we're paying attention to plants and birds and bugs and soil and wind and smells and noise from the highway nearby and whatever comes up. So everyone has a different experience of it. And every day is a different experience for each one of us. And so whenever my non-Zen friends ask me, well, what do you get out of meditating? Sometimes I say, I've gotten better at paying attention, which is, I value that a lot. I'm going to quote Robin Wall Kimmerer. So she's a woman she's an academic. She's a PhD botanist. She studies mosses. But she's also very deeply steeped in her Native American culture. And these two things can hold contrary views. But she's found ways to bridge these two worlds, and she's written really beautifully about it. She says, attentiveness alone can rival the most powerful magnifying lens. And I love that because I think what she's saying is our mind can be a tool, like a magnifying lens. It's a tool that we can learn to use skillfully. Ajahn Chah, who's a Thai Theravadan monk who practiced in the 20th century in the forest tradition, he writes about this attentiveness. He says, like the Buddha, we too should look around us and be observant because everything in the world is ready to teach us. With even a little intuitive wisdom, we'll be able to see clearly through the ways of the world. We'll come to understand that everything in the world is a teacher. Trees and vines can reveal the true nature of reality. With wisdom, there's no need to question anyone, no need to study. We can learn from nature enough to be enlightened because everything follows the way of truth. It does not diverge from truth. So then after our walk, we sit in the Zendo and we have a Dharma talk from one of the participants. We sort of take turns doing that. We chant, we light incense, the candles blow out. They blow up. We've just learned that's okay. We often chant the song of the grass hut. It's a popular choice. Seems to fit in. We eat lunch in silence, and then we have a work period, and we do things like prepare the fire pit and fetch ice, and we always prepare the Zendo tent. And then afterwards, we sit in Zazen, and we do Kinhin, and we prepare for the evening meal. And then after dinner, we have a fire, and we've been gravitating towards suspending the rule of silence at the fire and having the evening be a time of conversation and reflection. And this is sort of a evolving part of it. But it's not for small talk. Small talk doesn't really feel appropriate. It's sharing our discoveries and responding to the Dharma talk, sort of like we do an afternoon tea here during Sesshin. The night is much darker than in the city. And there's also sounds and smells, and that adds to the experience. And then we sleep because we have to get up at 4:30. So I want to share just a little bit about the place itself in case you haven't been to Illinois Beach State Park. It has a unique historical background. Dave, would you mind putting the clock there and turning it around so I don't go on and on? Thanks so much. So one starting point for thinking about a place is to think about its landforms. Illinois Beach has some really interesting landforms. So where we are here, and also there, not so long ago, was several miles of ice. We were under a huge glacier. And then when the glacier began to recede, this is like 14,000 years ago, it created this gigantic lake, way bigger than Lake Michigan. It's called Historic Lake Chicago. And then it gradually receded, and it left these beach lines. These beach lines are ridges, and it's just materials that the glacier carried with it. So sand and gravel, and these ridges. You can still see remnants of these beach lines right in Chicago. Ridge Avenue, that's a glacial ridge. That was one of the beach ridges from Glacial Lake Chicago. None of the nature, or not much of the nature, is left on Ridge Avenue. It's developed in Chicago. But up at Illinois Beach, you can see the ridges and then the swales between the ridges. And sometimes it's called a corduroy topography. And anyway, one thing that most people don't realize, or if they realize it, they don't think about it very often, is that the coastline is still changing. It's very dynamic. The lake levels are changing, and the wave action is moving sand, so it's eroding some parts and depositing in other parts. Dunes are growing and beaches lost. So it's really hard to think of a better example of impermanence than this alive shoreline. It's changing minute by minute and millennium by millennium. And also at the park, the biological diversity. The biodiversity is just stupendous. So just for plants alone, there's 650 species, which is a lot for one place. So, and then it has a very rich cultural history as well. So in the 1700s, it was part of the Three Fires of the Algonquin Nation, the Potawatomi, the Chippewa, and the Ottawa. Before then, it had been the Miami. And the French explorers were in there in the 1600s. And if you read the official website, you'll read this sentence. In 1836, a treaty was made with the local Native Americans who were moved westward, and the area became part of Lake County. So this is after Illinois became a state in 1818, which is a sanitized version of the story, which is really part of the shameful history of genocide of Native peoples in this continent. And then during the Civil War, it was Camp Logan, a prisoner of war camp. And World Wars I and II, it was a basic training center, and they had tanks up there on the dunes. And it became a park started in 1948. So I'm telling you all this because it would be a mistake to think that connecting with a landscape is all about beauty, serenity, butterflies, and wild orchids, and stars, etc. So I think we can think of this landscape as sacred, but that sacredness includes a lot of pain, a lot of change, and knowing that and sitting there, I think can help us generate compassion for billions, literally billions, probably trillions of sentient beings that have passed through over the years. So I'm going to quote Gary Snyder again. I just can't resist. He says, "Wilderness as a temple is only the beginning. One should not dwell in the specialness of the extraordinary experience. The best purpose of such studies and hikes is to be able to see all the land around us, agricultural, suburban, urban, as part of the same territory, never totally ruined, never completely natural, never completely unnatural." I think he's telling us that being in a place like this, doing this intimate action with this landscape can help us connect with all of the landscape, the larger landscape that we live in every day, and see them as special and extraordinary and cherish them and become intimate with. purpose. Everywhere is special, even though we think of it as ordinary. So camping session happens only once a year, and then, you know, at most a dozen or so people can do it. But several of us have been having this intermittent conversation about how we could offer some other outdoor experiences throughout the year to expand this nature practice to others. And this is what I'd love to talk about during the discussion, if people have ideas. So we've been discussing maybe monthly or bi-monthly or quarterly or semi-annually or whatever. We don't have, no, whatever we have the energy to do. Walking experiences together, or maybe biking experiences. There's lots of places in our region that we could do. And if we did it on a Saturday or a Sunday afternoon, a lot more people would be able to participate. And it would take some work to organize it, but it probably wouldn't be too much work if we kept it simple. Just bring our own lunch and set a date and people sign up. And a lot of us know a lot of great places we could share with each other, places that we care about. I know people go to the dunes in Indiana. I go to Palos, southwest suburb. And we might even be able to do on some ecological stewardship in one of these experiences, because one of the other stresses on the natural landscape is things like invasive species. There's just a lot of problems in our natural areas, so much smaller. We do a lot on them. So they benefit from our tender, loving care. So we might be able to do that. There actually is a group of volunteers that works at Illinois Beach. There are many volunteers. One time we worked and did some at the Chicago River, just a couple of miles from here. So I think I'm going to end there. I'm going to end with one sentence from Dogen. Enlightenment is intimacy with all things. So that is my talk for tonight. I'd love to hear anybody's thoughts about that, about anything we might do in the future. And I'll just say, I think there's still room in this year's camping session. It'll be June 20th to the 23rd, which is a Thursday night through Sunday, but you don't have to come for the whole thing. If you don't have a tent, I think we have people who have offered to loan people tents and help to put them up and things. You can talk to Aishan or to me, or send an email to info@ancientdragon if you have questions. There's a form to fill in. And thank you very much. Yes. You're welcome.
It's very
oh, yeah.
beautiful gets.
You know, what occurred to me as I was looking at the schedule for sitting on Sunday that I put in a couple longer, slightly longer Kenyan periods because I thought,
yeah.
During Sashimi, which I think even just in the city, there's a lot happening, like just in this little area here. So I was inspired to break out of the Zen. You know, I mean, Buddha, I kept thinking as you were talking, you know, this was Buddha's practice. Mm-hmm. Buddha didn't, they were homeless, man. They were living
right
on the road. And, you know, the talks were in outdoor venues. All sorts of animals, you know. So sitting outside and, you know, sit under a tree, put a mat, grass down, that was the kind of basic,
mm-hmm.
you know, Satipatthana instruction. So I just was just like delighting in, not that we're not doing that here, but there is something about getting kind of super cozy or basic, you know. The other thing I did want to mention is, you know, I'm actually a Potawatomi Indian.
Oh, I kind of knew that and forgot. Yeah.
So, you know, one of my ancestors was signatory on that treaty.
Oh my goodness!
Scammed once again by the U.S. government.
We should apologize.
They fled into Canada.
Yeah.
And got away from sort of being removed, and all the Potawatomis and that group of Indians were moved to Kansas or some other place, right? That was a famous world-class form of genocide, is to like take a group of people and move them to a whole other part of the land that they're not used to and strip them off.
Yeah, where they don't know the plants and they can't survive.
Right. I mean, that was done, it's done all over the world. So, but anyway, so I was kind of moved by that, thinking about that land and mm-hmm. connecting with it. Wonderful. Great thing. I heard your tent blew away.
Yes, the first night. It was dramatic. There are photos on the website. Asian took some very good photos. Yeah, the first year it was just duct tape and pins, but the second year more. But we did manage.
Yeah, that was not good, and it was. It seemed right at the time that we should continue, and I think that it was okay with me. I really feel badly that some people were really, really bitten by mosquitoes. Cautious about our shelter moving forward, because it's nice to practice equanimity with those things, but it's also not so great for your health. So that was really a lesson. But you know, camping and sashin have always seemed to be like the perfect combination mm-hmm. to me. But I think it was Matt who actually said it the best when you said, if you can accept that you're going to be a little uncomfortable, you can have an amazing time. Which is true for both camping and for sushi.
Yeah, right.
and so there's something that just feels very, very right about sitting out in the middle of nature and, you know, particularly because when we're in the camping zendo, when you look out, you're looking out through, ideally, screens
mm-hmm.
Onto just the landscape, and you're watching, you know, the sun go over the yard arm, and you're really just right there in a way that we can feel a little bit insulated. The other thing that always strikes me about camping and sashin is the ways that we really very clearly depend on one another in this experience. We do during an ordinary day of sashin, but we're also a little bit insulated from that. But I know as Tenzo, you know, my day revolves around boiling water and how much water I can boil and how much fire I can get to boil the water and who's going to be bringing the water and where they will be getting it from. And so it really brings, you know, your practice to the everyday in a way that it just doesn't feel the same with all the modern conveniences of running water and stoves and things. And even as campers, we're not completely just, you know, living off the land. You know, somebody's going to get firewood, and we've got propane tanks, and, you know, we've got a little electric water heater for when we just absolutely can't boil water fast enough, and we need more water to be boiled right now. But it really does bring that feeling of intimacy with our fellow participants, with the environment, and, you know, with the rhythms of the day to life in a way that it's pretty direct.
Right. I really appreciate being reminded that most people don't have water, you know, just flip a thing and endless water comes out without any effort at all. I really appreciate that we are unique in the history of humanity, and only a small number of those on the planet now have that convenience. So it's a really good thing to be reminded of. Helps us understand what's going on in this world.
So I'm inspired by your nature walk idea that turned on my activist fundraiser brain. I mean, one thing you could do if you wanted to, or if it made sense, is do those nature walks quarterly or whenever we do them, and use it as fundraisers for whatever organization that we find that works that combats climate change, and that can be a way we can interact with our
raise communities. Awareness and
yeah,
raise.
Yeah, like, hey, we're doing this nature walk to place X, and we're trying to, you know, in support of raise $200 for, you know, and climate change or whatever organization you find. It can be kind of a way of interacting with not people who don't directly practice, but for them to kind of be involved and for the circle to kind of keep moving. So that's one idea for them. I also wanted to, for Mr. Rees, I was going through some of the Lotus Sutra recently, and he wrote the translation of the Lotus Sutra that we have in the library, and the one that, I was putting that name together when we were doing that memorial service, and we heard that name and the done that translation. So this is just like a little paragraph that really stuck with me. This is from page 416 of the Lotus Sutra in Jindri's translation. What is sin? What is virtue? As the thought of self is itself empty, neither sin nor virtue is our master. In this way, all things are neither permanent nor destroyed. If one repeats like this, meditating on one's mind, one finds no mind. Things also do not dwell in things. All things are liberated, show the truth of extinction, and are calm and tranquil. Such a thing is called great repentance, sublime repentance, repentance without sin, the destruction of consciousness of mind. People who practice this repentance are pure in body and mind, are flowing water, not attached to things. Whenever they reflect, they will be able to see universal sage bodhisattva in the Buddhas in all directions.
Thank you. It was a very moving performance this evening, I thought. Jerry, you had your hand up.
You know, I've been to a couple of them. I got bit off pretty bad, but it kind of speaks to what Laura was saying. The dog and hearing the birds. Hey, you know, you're sleeping on rocks. And it's both, you know, and both of them are, you know, but it worked out okay. And the other thing that I really noticed about the Cajun Shishin, is when you come to an all-day Shishin or a Shishin here, you know, the cooks are kind of behind that wall. You don't really see them. They do a ton of work. Just to make one meal takes effort, and it takes a long time, and it's amazing how much work the cooks do. When I see Asian cooking at a camping Shishin, it's like, really, girl? I don't know if I would give that much. Right? It's impressive.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So I appreciated, like, you talking about the sacred land. Made me think about the everything sacred, nothing sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, with our roof / ceiling at someone's floor. And I sometimes I make stories, especially when I think it's a dog up there. but I don't know, actually. Like at Green Gulch, there's a roof as well, and it's the bird's floor, and they walk. And so, like, that seems like more like special than a dog running on the floor/ceiling. But why, right? Like,
right. It's
that story, right? It's like, I don't know. Like, I think it's easy to, like, yeah, I like that. Like, it's like, oh, sitting in nature. It's like, yeah, like. The Abbas at the time, she was attacked by a skunk on the way to the Zendo in her, all of her clothes. I tried to go and run to the Zendo at 4:30 in the morning. I was not a very punctual student.
Did she get sprayed?
Yeah, all of her robes, Linda Kutz did, in her black and brown, and all it was took a very long time to undo all of that. so like nature happens, right? But like, so yeah, I just kind of think about the sacred nature. I was trying to think of the sangha that did the urban sits back in like the 60s or 70s. And I think it was like on the sidewalks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Burning glass.
Yeah, they did Auschwitz and
yeah,
other
right.
places. Yeah.
Yeah, so like I was just kind of thinking about like how nature is special and how everything is nature too.
That's why I keep walking out here.
Yeah.
In the street, doing kinhin in our urban area.
I think it's a great idea. Other comments? Well, thank you all.
Oh. I also just want to encourage you too that, like, I don't know if there's going to be a full moon when they're out, but like during a full moon ceremony outside,
is good idea.
What the monks used to do. And I actually did that myself.
That's a great idea.
It's really a wonderful, like that kind of experience is. It's pretty awesome.
It's a really great idea. It's the summer solstice, so